Before we officially start, I'll unofficially greet our newly confirmed commissioner. And of course, Mr. Morin, Reed Morin, is brand new to the commission. Welcome.
Welcome.
And then we have how many got confirmed? I think
four others. Yeah.
Yep. Antonio, Margaret,
Karen,
and Duggan. Congratulations, all. You survived it. Yeah. You're official. You can vote now. Anyway, welcome aboard, and congratulations to everybody, and thank you all for being here today. The meeting is called to order May 27, 2009 at 9.05 a.m. or whatever. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Are you okay?
I'm ready.
Okay. We will begin with Regulations Committee. Commissioner Friedkin, please call your committee to order.
Thank you. First order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Motion for approval.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, moved by Commissioner Bivens, second by Hickson. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, update on progress in implementing land and water resource conservation and recreation plan. Carter.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate it. I guess just as a point of departure, it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce a couple of new members of our leadership team that are with us today. And so I want to call them out and see if we can't embarrass them publicly. Ross Melinchuk, our new Deputy Executive Director for Natural Resources. Ross comes to us from Ducks Unlimited, was there 17 years, and before that with the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, very instrumental in implementing the North American Waterfowl Management Plans and putting together the joint ventures across the country. And so Ross is joining the leadership team, and Ross, welcome aboard. Then right in front of him is Mike Jensen. Mike is our new chief financial officer, going to be starting next Monday, and so he'll have a week ahead of Ross, so he'll have his sea legs well ahead of him. Mike is an accountant and attorney, and before coming here, he's been with the comptroller's office and was formerly the chief financial officer at the Animal Health Commission, and grew up just down the road here in Del Valle. So he's a hometown boy, and delighted to have both of them on board. So welcome, Ross and Mike, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. A couple other things that I want to mention to the commission. First, I'd like to ask permission to publish rules to implement legislation that we think will get passed or has been passed during the course of this session. This is kind of a customary action item that we do with the commission during legislative years. There's going to be certain legislation that's passed that's going to require us to implement rules on the 1st of September. In order to meet that deadline, we're going to be asking for your permission to publish rules in the Federal Register in advance of the August Commission meeting so that you can consider them then. And so we're going to be asking your permission to do that in the Public Register. I want to thank all of you who were able to make it to the groundbreaking at the Game Warden Training Center there in Hamilton. That was a very, very special day for us as we got the shovels out and cut the ribbons.
Big deal.
It was a big deal. It was a big deal. And had our seminal class there. 51 cadets are flying towards graduation on the 9th of June. I hope that all of you can make that. It'll be in the House chambers. It is a great, great cast of very, very well qualified men and women that'll go out and represent this agency very, very well around the state. So help us welcome them on board on the 9th of June. Last thing that I want to mention to all of you, at the last meeting, You supported a very proactive measure to help us take action to conserve alligator gar populations in our rivers throughout the state. And with that, though, came a directive from the commission for our team to reach out to the bow fishermen and make sure that we were doing all we could to work with that community to collect data on alligator gar. Our inland fisheries team has been working very closely with that community since then. Attended a recent bow fishing tournament on the Trinity River in which they talked about the new regulation, asked for the support and cooperation of the bow fishermen, explained the importance of it, significance of it, and by all accounts, That relationship is going very, very well, so I'm real pleased with the Inland Fisheries team and what they've done since that regulation was enacted and reaching out to that community. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it back over to you and request permission to publish.
Great. Any questions about the request? Okay. No further questions. I'll authorize staff to publish rules necessary to implement legislation enacted during the 81st Texas Legislature in the Texas Register and required public comment period. Thanks, Carter. Committee item number two, proposed oyster restoration rules, permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Robin.
For the record, my name is Robin Reichert of the Coastal Fisheries Division. Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, the item before you is a permission to publish regarding the oyster fishery, and just to kind of give you a quick overview of the oyster fishery since we haven't had an item before you in a little while in regards to this. Within that fishery, we have both the public oyster reef opportunity or harvesting opportunity, and we also have private oyster leases. The public oyster reef season runs from November 1 through April 30th, and while the private oyster leases can actually be harvested year-round, predominantly that harvest period occurs from May to October. When you look at the value of this fishery brings in about $18 million a year to the state of Texas ex vessel value, which is dockside value, and that's from about 5 million pounds, which are harvested meat weight at dockside. When we look at Galveston Bay makes up 50 to 55% of the total harvest and value of this fishery. The lease program is confined only to Galveston Bay, and it makes up roughly about 20% of the overall value in the fishery. When we look at participation, we have about 695 boats now licensed to be in this fishery, and that's in the public reef fishery, and we have 43 overall oyster leases. When we look at public reef area, we have about 47,000, 48,000 total acres of open reefs and closed reefs. And when I say a closed reef, that's a reef that is closed because the Department of Health has basically deemed that area that we should not harvest oysters from due to pollution. And that's actually what supports the lease program, that they are allowed to transplant those oysters from those polluted areas, put them on their leases, they depurate them or cleanse them for a period of about 2 weeks, and then they're available for harvest after that period of time. When you look at the oyster lease program, just to give you some idea of the number of acres under it, it has about 2,700 acres in that program.
And Robin, when they move them over, then who okays it once they're cleaned? The health department?
Certainly, if the waters are yes, basically, I mean, the health department and us as well monitoring the current situations, but you know, we're the ones who issue the harvest permit, so we will not issue a harvest permit unless there's been appropriate amount of time off of that lease, 15 days basically, within the opportunity of a transplant. So you know, we help ensure that as well as Department of Health and in those, you know, open and closed areas. The proposal before you today, and again, it's a permission to publish. It's a permission to publish. What we're doing is an oyster reef restoration in East Bay. This particular restoration or oyster reef was actually silted over in shale dredging in the 1970s. And when Hurricane Katrina and Rita, some of the disaster relief money that came through for that, we basically targeted this as one of our restoration sites. The permitted area that we have there is 350 acres. The site we're actually going to be working on is about a 20-acre site. It's going to cost us in the neighborhood of about $700,000 to restore this reef area. Our proposed rule change, in a nutshell, is to close East Bay. We're going to do that for two seasons, which means it will open up starting with the license year, September 1, 2011. And we're going to use a current approved area boundary that was established by the Department of State Health Services. I'll try to explain this, and I apologize, the map is a little bit small. The yellow or orange line, I guess, is the line with the little circles on them, is that approved area. And that's already a designated area where Department of State Health Services opens and closes, depending on as they get floods and so forth, and we need to close areas. They have an approved area that they can already open up East Bay or close East Bay, depending on what they need to do there. So We're going to use that existing line, or at least we're going to propose to use that existing line. The kind of purple or magenta is the proposed restoration site that you see there. The blue areas are actual reefs, public reefs throughout the East Bay area. And then the kind of yellow lines there with the numbers beside them are actual oyster leases that are in that area.
Robin, is this whole area affected?
Yes. What we're proposing to do is close that entire area to the public oyster season for a period of 2 years. Now, we normally wouldn't close that entire area because we could possibly go in and buoy that, but in this particular area, roughly 80%, when we did our site assessments right after Hurricane Ike, we think 80% of these reef areas have been impacted. And anecdotally, we've even heard that really last season there weren't just a few boats in there. So in addition, what we're going to be doing right now and as we're moving forward in time is doing site assessments of those public reef areas that are in there and determining which restoration method will work best. If under Hurricane Ike disaster relief, if we find that the sediment is less than 6 inches, we believe we can basically hire oyster fishermen to go in, remove their bags, and basically kind of a plowing notion. They basically let their dredges drop, go over that reef area, and it'll bring that culture material back to the top. And so within that context of that disaster relief grant, we have some money set aside for that activity. If it is below greater than 6 inches of siltation, sediment overload, we're going to have to go in and use a similar kind of culture replacement option.
What's the status of this large public reef area?
We believe it's 80% impacted right now. So, you know, even though we are closing a larger area, we believe it would, you know, we would be back here closing that area if we didn't do it right now for this other reef area anyhow. So, you know, we think we can go ahead and do that, do our site evaluations, and, you know, hopefully in a two-year period get that reclamation work done in that area.
And oyster leases, what goes on there then relative to what we're going to do?
Relative to the oyster leases, basically those folks have already, you know, been on those leases and tried to remove that siltation or sediment overload already. So, you know, they basically are back in business. Now, relative to what goes on there is we permit those to both transplant the polluted oysters to their lease, and then we also permit that harvest. So, you know, that activity can still go on, and certainly we work really closely with law enforcement when those activities are ongoing so that, you know, everyone knows what's going on out there and why those boats would be out there and to ensure that they only work on their leases during that time period.
How are these leases delineated in place? I mean, how do you differentiate one area from another?
Well, they're surveyed and platted just like you would another parcel of land through the General Land Office. It's filed at the county level. There haven't been any leases issued in many years now, over 20 years. This was a program that started, you know, quite some time ago. But basically, it's just like any other kind of deed in that respect.
Robin, I think the question he had, if I could, was are they marked by buoys or
are they just... They're marked by buoys. Yes.
No barbed wire fences out there.
No. The leaseholders are required to have them marked by buoys and maintain those buoys. Yes.
I'm a panhandle boy. I don't know how to work.
Mr. Duggins.
Your request does not include a request to close the leased areas. Is that right?
That's correct.
But if 80% of the bay is affected and we're trying to restore the whole bay, why wouldn't we consider closing those as well and extending the lease by 2 years or abating the rent or both in order to achieve better results in the entire bay area?
Well, I'll try to answer that in two ways. One is by them actually transplanting oysters to that and then those oysters creating spat set as well, we can actually maybe help the spat set in that area and actually get more spat set, and which is juvenile oyster setting on that culture material that we're trying to create there. So that's one way. And the other way is, you know, those folks, you know, we can still allow them to work those leases through that permitting process. So their leases have already, they've already worked those leases and tried to get that culch material back up already. You know, they were out doing that very quickly after the storm. So they're actually ready to work those leases. They can go ahead and do that. It's the public reef areas that we haven't been able to really go in and assess completely yet and work yet. Again, our preliminary assessment says they were about 80% affected, but, you know, we're going to go in with our side scan sonar work and the other work that we're doing and actually determine that sediment load and what reclamation will work best.
How did we pick this 20 acre? You may have mentioned that, but the 20 acre.
It was a site that was silted over in the 1970s due to shale dredging activity.
Right.
It has a shale base at the bottom of it, covered up now. So we think we can, you know, it will actually hold a reef up there. And it was targeted when we had the Katrina and Rita money to allow us to go in and try to create some restoration.
So it's a more effective target area than the larger blue to the west?
Well, when we targeted, I'm not saying it's more effective. When we targeted it, it was long before we had the issues in the blue area to the west. And certainly that blue area to the west now with the Hurricane Ike money will be part of our reclamation effort there.
Commissioner Bivens.
What percentage is this area of the entire oyster industry in the Gulf or in the Texas Gulf?
Well, Galveston Bay makes up 50%, and of course East Bay, you know, makes up a pretty good chunk of that 50% there in our area. So
it's kind of the heart of that.
It's significant. I'll put it that way. Certainly significant.
Robin, where does the lease money, where does this particular money go?
That money actually is paid to Texas Parks and Wildlife Department and goes into our revenue stream.
Do you know how much that is per year?
It's $6 per acre, so 6 times the 2,800, you know, basically $12,000, $13,000, $14,000, something in that neighborhood.
Any other questions? Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it. All right, I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item number 3, Migratory Game Bird Proclamation, Early Season Regs. Dave, I believe?
Corey. Good morning. For the record, I'm Corey Mason, Webless Migratory Game Bird Program Leader. I'm going to provide an update on early season proposals and provide a summary of these proposals. We have 3 possible options for September till season, a 16-day season, a 9-day season, and a closed season. The length of the season is determined by breeding population surveys. We will not know which package will be given to us by the Fish and Wildlife Service until after the June Service Regulations Committee meeting. If offered the 16-day season, we're suggesting running September 12th through the 22nd, the 27th, and the 9-day season September 19th through the 27th. Here's an illustration of what we're proposing. The 16-day option would run the last 2 weeks and last 3 full weekends here in September. And the 9-day option, the last week and 2 weekends of September. These are the proposed dates for rail, gallinule, snipe, and woodcock. There are no changes proposed for these species. These are just calendar adjustments from last year. You'll notice that rail and gallinules, we've attempted to run this concurrent with the early September till season, but once again, we do not know the final ruling on the dates that will be offered regarding the September till season. The one thing you might note is the consistent opening and closing date of woodcock season. The reason for this being is we're allowed 45 days for woodcock season, the latest date being January the 31st, so we run the calendar back into the calendar 45 days, which gives us that consistent opening date of December the 18th. We have several changes this year proposed for dove. One is the adoption of an adaptive harvest management season structure strategy for dove, which results in a 70-day season and 15 bird bags statewide. Proposing to move the south zone opening to the Friday nearest September the 20th, but no earlier than the 17th. And also proposing to adjust a portion of the special white-winged dove area boundary, specifically in Jim Hogg and Starr counties. Currently, the existing federal framework states that the 20th is the earliest opening date that's allowed in the south zone. Commission policy has been in the past to open dove season on the Friday the first Friday after the 20th, unless the 20th falls on Saturday. Now, so in effect, in most years, we've opened about 3 days later than federal frameworks allow, and as late as the 25th. Now, you'll notice that this year that the 20th falls on a Sunday, so under current structure, we would open this year on the 25th, on that Friday following. This year, we're proposing that the South Zone open on the Friday, nearest the 20th, but not earlier than the 17th. The service has heard this proposal and have received it favorably, and we're expecting that it be offered to us in the latter part of June after the SRC meeting. So this year, instead of opening on the 25th, we're proposing that we open on the 18th. Next year, the 20th falls on a Monday, so we'd be proposing then under that structure that it open on Friday the 17th. These are the proposed dates for all zones. With 10 new additional days in the North Zone, you'll notice that there's a proposed late season segment there, that December 26th through January the 9th. This is proposed to run concurrently with the Central Zone late season segment. And once again, the South Zone will open on the 18th, we're proposing, instead of the 25th this year. For the special white winged dove area, September 5th and 6th and 12th and 13th are the early 4 days allowed. These are half-day hunts from noon to sunset. And these are the Saturday, Sundays of the first 2 weekends. Now, as I mentioned earlier, with the adoption of the new AHM season structure, which resulted in a 15-bird statewide, that did not apply to these early 4 days in the special white-winged dove area because this is a special season. So for statewide consistency and for law enforcement simplicity, we've approached the service since the last commission meeting and asked them to consider enabling us to offer a 15-bird bag during these early 4 days. The service has viewed this favorably, and we anticipate it will be offered to us as well. The 4 and the 2 there you see during the early 4 days, that is a species restriction on mourning dove. This is not something new. Up to 15 birds in the aggregate, only 4 of which could be up to mourning dove, and the 2 white tip is a statewide regulation. Once the general season opens September the 18th, there are no further restrictions on mourning dove. It's an aggregate bag of 15 birds total. The service is also reviewing a proposal to adjust a portion of the boundary of the special white-winged dove area. This area is proposed in Jim Hogg and Starr counties, and the reason for this being is these areas are not as high production areas for white-winged dove as other portions of the special white-winged dove area. These areas are more representative of mourning dove habitat. It's being proposed that they're removed and be placed into the South Zone, and then they would fall under South Zone dates and bag at that time. This is a close-up of that area. The black line coming out of Hebronville South there is at FM 1017 for point of reference. The yellow area indicates the area that would be removed from the special white-winged dove area. These are the proposed dates for falconry season. Bag limit during these is 3. Please remember that this is in addition to the general season. Falconry can be used during the general season. This is just simply the falconry-only season. This is a summary of the public comment that we've received through the website and then direct emails to us. You can see that greater than 90% are in favor of the proposals here being offered. This is a summary of the public comment from public meetings that were held recently across the state. You can see that basically there are, it's all in favor of regarding the 15 birds, 70 days, boundary change. And under
numbers total votes.
Sorry?
Are these total votes?
Yes.
Too small turnout. Sorry.
The service will not issue their early season framework decision until late June because there's not a commission meeting between July and early August. The executive director will utilize rulemaking of authority delegated under commission under 31 Texas Administrative Code 65.313 to adopt early season proposals and rules, which allows them to take effect before the opening day of dove season, September the 1st. With that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thanks, Corey. Any questions? Commissioner Doug?
What day of the week does the second south zone in 17th of January? What day is that? Sunday or?
I'm not sure. Let's see.
I think when we discussed this, we talked about it ending on the Sunday immediately preceding Martin Luther King holiday.
Yes, sir. We add that as a scoping meeting, and one of the things that's not presented here is we had an additional portion of our public meeting, an additional thing that we're going to put on the website about scoping issues for next year, regulation changes. So we put that out there for available comment, and one of the questions that we asked is if we asked the public if it were more important for a consistent opening date of that late segment, the day after Christmas, or a consistent closing date, and we're currently receiving comment on that related to that specific thing to see if it's more important in the eyes of the hunters for that December 26th opening or consistent closing date. And that's where that stands right now.
But what day, do you know what day the 17th is?
I do not know offhand right now.
It's a Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that would be an August decision?
This is a Sunday, so I think that accomplishes what his question is asking, but I think we'll continue to scope this question is what Corey is saying. Yeah.
We attempt to open these seasons either on Friday or Saturday and close on a Sunday, but whenever we have split, sometimes it in the middle of the week, we don't always result in a Sunday closure.
Got it. Okay. Any other questions? Corey, thank you. I appreciate it. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 4, Raptor Proclamation. Matt Wagner.
Actually, we still got Dave Morrison on the late season waterfowl.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course we do. Dave, sorry.
Good morning. My name is Dave Morrison. I'm the waterfowl program leader for the Wildlife Division, and this morning I'm going to be presenting to you season dates, proposed season dates for the 2009-2010 for ducks, geese, merganser, cranes, and all these other late season migratory species. To get started, though, I would like to tell you that these seasons are based on a liberal duck package of 74 days, a season that can run no later than January 31st, and a six-bird bag limit. Understand that the information that we need to formalize the frameworks through the Fish and Wildlife Service will not be collected. We're collecting it now, but we will not have a final decision on what package will be offered until late July. Should the package come back as something other than a liberal season, then a lot of these things have to be adjusted pretty dramatically. With respect to changes this year, hunter's choice probably will not be an option, so we're going to have to be looking at a conventional bag limit. We're looking at an earlier closing date than what the frameworks allow for in Texas. Not giving up days, just changing when we close the season. We're also considering a modification to the youth hunting season, as well as we're suggesting a proposed change in the sandhill crane season structure. This is what the dates would look like and what the staff would recommend to this commission with respect to the duck season of the High Plains Milder Management Unit. They're looking at a youth season of October 7th, 17th through the 18th, a general gun season that would run October 24th and 25th, close for a few days, reopen on Friday, October the 30th, and run to January 24th. So what that season would look like on a calendar, with the gray shaded areas being the youth hunting season, yellow being what the season the staff would recommend, and that highlighted red date is the last date that the framework will allow for under a liberal package. The staff is recommending that we do not run until the 31st. In the north and south zone, this is what a season would look like, with an October 24th, 25th youth-only season, general gun season from October 31st through November the 29th, which will be the Sunday after Thanksgiving. Close down for a couple of weeks, reopen on December the 12th, and run through January 24th. Again, this is what it would look like on the calendar, with the gray shaded area being the youth hunt, yellow being what staff would recommend with respect to the duck season, running to the 24th, and again, not running to the end of the framework. I would say that if the season were shifted to run to the end of the framework, that would push this whole thing back about a week, and the opening day of the duck season and deer season would fall on the same day of November the 7th. We do not suggest that if the season for the regular season change, moving that youth hunt. We're trying to keep that youth waterfowl season separate from the youth deer season. So any changes that would be made to the duck season, we're proposing or suggesting that we leave that youth season right where it is so it does not have a conflict with youth deer season. One of the major changes this year is going to be the hunter's choice. You may recall that several years ago we had closed or partially closed seasons on species like pintails and camelsback. That was something that the Central Flyway never did really like, so the Central Flyway worked together with the Fish and Wildlife Service and developed what was called the Hunter's Choice Bag Limit. And Hunter's Choice Bag Limit, one of the key components, was the aggregate bag of pintails, mallard hens, mottled ducks, and canvasbacks. Keep the season open, the entire season length, but you only take one of those in the aggregate per day. We had a 3-year study that ended last year. This year we will be taking that information, analyzing the data, and determine did Hunter's Choice actually have an impact when you're looking at these species that may need some extra protection. We'll find out how it compares to a season-long season or a season-finished season. Next spring, during the next regulatory process, we will take that information to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, lay it on the table, say, okay, folks, this is what we have. At that time, the service will determine, is Hunter's Choice a viable option? But for this year, we do not believe there is an outside chance, but more than likely, we will be going to a conventional bag limit. This is what a conventional bag limit would look like in the upcoming season. Bag limit of 6 birds with species and sex restrictions as indicated. One of the changes is we'd have 3 wood ducks. That's different than it's been in the past. Those species in red, anytime you go to a conventional bag limit, there is always the opportunity that you could have a closed or partially closed season. Those species in red are the ones that probably, if something were to happen, would be the ones that would be looked at for that partially closed or closed season. It would be a 6-bird bag limit. This is the season, the bag limit structure we had prior to Hunter's Choice, with the one exception being the 3 wood ducks. Understand that there are 2 options here. But when the service issues its final framework, Texas will have 1 option, Hunter's Choice or conventional bag. Moving on to the goose seasons. This is what the goose seasons being recommended or proposed by the staff would look like in the West Zone. An opening of November the 7th and February the 7th, with a daily bag limit of 20 in the aggregate for white geese, for dark geese, 4 Canadas, and 1 white-fronted goose. The possession limit on dark geese would be twice the daily bag limit. For light geese, there is no possession limit. We are also suggesting a light goose conservation order on February the 8th, which opens the day after the last day of the goose season. In East Zone, these are what the dates look like. There is a slight change from what you have in your packet, because during the course of the public hearings that we went to, we heard some things and we have modified the package as a result. Texas has basically offered 107 days for both white geese, for light geese and Canada geese. Historically and in the recent past, we have shortened that season to take advantage of the light goose conservation order. This year, your package shows it running the 31st. However, during the course of the public hearings, we heard that they wanted the light goose season to close the day after duck season to allow them to open the conservation season as early as possible. In response to the few comments that we had, the staff is suggesting that we go ahead and close the goose season, just like we've had in the past, and run the conservation order starting the day after duck season closes. White-fronted geese a little bit different because we only have 72 days to work with. All these seasons we're trying to open concurrent with the duck season. So they're all going to open the same day the duck season opens. But because we only have 72 days for white-fronted goose hunting, it does have to close a little bit earlier than both the light and the Canada goose season. Daily bag limit would be just like the West Zone, 20 in the aggregate for white geese, no possession limit. For dark geese, it would be 3 Canada geese and 2 white-fronted geese per day with possession limit twice the daily bag limit. As I mentioned, the conservation order would open the day after duck season closes. Again, it's a little bit changed from what's in your packet. It would be January 25th versus what you saw in your packet February 1st. This is in response to some of the comments we got to the public hearing. Sandhill cranes, we have 3 zones in the state of Texas. In zone A and B, we can open from September 1st to February the 28th. In zone A, we're suggesting a season very similar to last year, simple calendar adjustments from November 7th to February the 7th, with bag limit 3. Zone B, that season opens 3 weeks later, even though we're off the same number of days. But understand that Texas has made the decision to delay that opening for 3 weeks to allow any whoopers migrating through that area to get in and out of there and down on Aransas before we open that season. Zone C is where we're having a little bit of change from last year. The Fish and Wildlife Service has a framework that allows us up to 37 days for sandhill crane hunting. But tied back to the conservation order, if we want to have a light goose conservation order, all migratory bird seasons have to be closed. If, in fact, we want to open the light goose conservation season the day after the duck season closes, it means we would give up 7 days of crane hunting in Zone C. It would open from December 26th through January the 24th. There's not a lot of crane hunters down there. There are a few, but this is something that we believe that the goose hunters have really wanted to open that season the day after duck season. Suggested dates for the 2009-2010 falconry season. In the north and south zones, be January 25th through February the 8th. But in the High Plains Mallard Management Unit, there is no falconry season simply because we have used the full 107 exposure days allowed for waterfowl hunting during the course of the year. With that, I'll end this and take any questions you may have.
What's your recommendation between the two bags, the hunter's choice and the conventional bag, if you had a choice?
I had a choice based on information. The Central Flyway conducted a survey of all 10 states. And when you look at the information, the preference of duck hunters, both in hunter's choice states and even in states that have not experienced hunter's choice, they prefer hunter's choice.
Well, sure.
Because it is a simpler regulation.
Yeah.
But until we can get this data analyzed and provide to the service that, okay, hunter's choice does not dramatically change overall harvest. Now, the gold standard, they say, okay, we're going to have season and season. Well, the Central Flyway view, and my view also, is that that should not necessarily be the gold standard. Let's look at another option, because we're worried about hunters and simplicity for hunters. And that's the reason Hunter's Choice was developed, a much simpler approach to dealing with these species that may not be able to handle high harvest pressure. But yes, sir, I would prefer Hunter's Choice. And I think in Texas, you do see, even in that survey that was done, a high percentage, 60 to 65% of the people in Texas prefer Hunter's Choice over the conventional bag.
Any other questions? Okay, so now I authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Item 4, Rapid Proclamation, Federal Certification of Parks and Wildlife Falconry Rules. Permission to publish.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. We're seeking permission to publish amendments to our falconry proclamation. With me this morning is Matt Reedy. Matt's a wildlife biologist for us down in Floresville, very active falconer, serves as liaison to the Falconry Raptor Council. To give you some background, Chapter 49 of Parks and Wildlife Code requires a department to issue falconry permits for possession of native raptors. The state regulations, of course, must comply with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service requirements. The Fish and Wildlife Service has recently revised federal falconry regs to give states administrative authority for falconry permitting. This administrative authority requires certification of state rules by September 1, 2009. In some instances, the current state rules are at variance with the new federal rules. So the proposed amendment would make provisional alterations to temporarily eliminate conflicts with federal falconry rules. And this will allow for the certification of the state permit program while our state falconry regulations are revised. The department is currently working with the Falconry and Raptor Council to draft new state falconry regulations, which should be completed in 6 months. And with us in the room this morning are Steve Olson and Sheldon Nicole, both with the Falconry and Raptor Council. So staff requests permission to publish the amendment as presented in the Texas Register for public comment. Are there any questions maybe Matt can help us with?
The federal guidelines are more restrictive. I've read through them. Am I reading that correctly? I mean, they in certain instances they are.
The changes are more restrictive, but they're supported by the falconry community. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Basically, they provide a lot more clarity, and we want to adopt the regulations, but there are some regulations that aren't germane to Texas, about 6 pages worth, that we wouldn't, of course, include.
And how many permittees do we have in Texas?
Roughly about 200.
Mm-hmm. Is that number growing?
Yes. It's actually, I think it's closer to 350 now of licensed falconers in the state.
Great.
What would that have been 10 years ago, just to give us some idea? Just get asking off the top of
your head. Well, I started about 12 years ago, so I probably didn't know back then, but maybe Steve Olson or Sheldon Nicole may be able to tell us better that.
Yeah, quickly.
How many...
Let me just speak up.
How many permits were there 10 years ago?
10 years ago, less than 150.
Really? Good.
And this would... provide for a single permit as opposed to both, right? As long
yes.
as the state is in compliance with federal guidelines, then the state can issue it and...
The feds are pretty much trying to get out of the
federal
system.
Okay.
Yeah. What they're trying
Good.
To do.
Good. Thank you very much.
That's actually question. Some simplification, huh?
That's the goal.
That's the goal, yeah.
And this is this option offered in any of the surrounding states?
All states. All states need to certify as soon as they can. All states have a falconry program.
Basically, by 2014, Fish and Wildlife Service will no longer be permitting falconers.
Really?
Yes.
So that will really simplify the process.
Yes, and it'll be cheaper, too, because falconers today have to have the state permit, which has a fee, and the federal fee.
So the difference between what we're doing temporarily and what we'll ultimately adopt or propose in 6 months or so, I mean, it obviously still has to be consistent with the federal guidelines, but
Correct.
There may be other things that are specific to Texas that you might recommend. Is that the difference?
Well, basically, we want to go through the certification as early as possible, using our state regulations, but then deferring to the federal regulations where they're more restrictive. And then in 6 months, we will completely revise our state falconry regs to be consistent with those federal regs.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? All right, so no further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Find the right spot here. Okay. Item number 5, exotic species, water spinach regulations. Permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Roll.
Mr. Chairman, other members of the Commission, for the record, my name is Earl Chilton. I'm Aquatic Habitat Enhancement Program Director for Inland Fisheries Division. Water spinach is an exotic species that is native to India and Southeast Asia. It's a part of the morning glory family. It's within the morning glory family. And that's the same family that includes sweet potatoes. Been cultivated since at least 300 AD in China, and it has high protein content. It can be used as animal feed. In addition, Vietnamese doctors tell me that it's got iron, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin E. They're pretty high on the product. In Texas, we've known about, it was one of the first plants that was placed on our exotic species list in the early 90s. Since I wasn't here at that time, it's difficult to say exactly why, but I presume it's because of the high growth rate. It grows very fast, and at the time, the herbicides that were used weren't very effective on it. But that, as you'll see a little later, that's changed somewhat. It may have been due to problems that it has caused in tropical areas around the world as well. In 2003, law enforcement became aware that water spinach was actually being grown and sold in the Asian community and elsewhere, and that included such places as HEB, Whole Foods. Basically, it was being sold around the state. At that time, in conjunction with law enforcement, conducted what we termed a sting operation. We confiscated several hundred pounds of it in the Houston area, gave people warnings, told them that it was illegal. At that time, we learned that about the extent of the growing. At that time, it looked like there were about 60 growers, and in some cases, they were harvesting some 50,000 pounds a week. So we met with the Vietnamese Chamber of Commerce. At the meeting, there were at least 200 people there. Vietnamese and Cambodian doctors testified how good it was. We learned that there were several types of it. This was a type that probably didn't grow very well outside of greenhouses, and so forth. Most of the production has taken place in near the Rocheron area, just outside of Houston, in what they call the village. In terms of the origin of the village, the founders apparently escaped the Khmer Rouge about 30 years ago, migrated to the Houston area, and began to grow the plant in greenhouses. There's a good reason why they're growing it in greenhouses, and I'll talk about that a little later. This is an image of what the greenhouses look like. Currently, there are about 80 growers. They employ over 200 people, and a conservative estimate from the producers suggests that it's at least $1 million industry at this time. It should be noted that it's advantageous for the producers to harvest water spinach before it goes to seed. Apparently, once they allow it to go to seed, the productivity is significantly decreased, and in some cases the plants die and they have to start all over again. We have conducted examinations in 2003. We conducted surveys in and around the area. We focused on the Rocheron area and in downtown Houston. We learned that there were rumors that people may have been growing water spinach in their backyard, so we followed those up too. We were unable to find any growing in anybody's backyard at that time. Despite the number of hurricanes we've had over the last few years, you would think it would be fragments, seeds, and so forth. We have been unable to find water spinach growing in the wild anywhere outside the greenhouses. We looked in the in ditches, bayous, creeks, and again in the Houston area, and it just wasn't there at this time. It's only growing in greenhouses. No water spinach was even found in the area around the greenhouses that had been destroyed in the hurricanes. Well, and by the way, this is what it looks like if you're going to eat it as a vegetable. After we were unable to find water spinach growing outside the greenhouses, Mr. DeRocher asked me to investigate the possibility of simply taking it off the prohibited list. In order to do that, we thought the first step would be to conduct a risk assessment, similar to risk assessments that have been done in other states such as Oregon, and that's what we did. This is some of the information that we uncovered. Water spinach requires, according to these researchers, a mean daily temperature in excess of 77 degrees. That's 25 degrees C. The average daily temperature in Houston, even though we think of Houston as being pretty hot, is actually 68.8 degrees. And the average daily temperature in none of Texas's top 20 cities exceeds 77 degrees. So it's even in Brownsville, the mean daily temperature is 73 degrees. So it's unlikely that the plant will be able to grow outside of greenhouses here in Texas. Currently, water spinach is established in three states. The larger map makes it look like it's all over California and Florida. That's why I wanted to show some maps of California and Florida. In fact, there are only small beds of water spinach in only two counties in both California and Florida. In Florida, and I talked to officials in Florida here recently, according to the last survey, it was found in no public water bodies and just a few retention ditches. And the person that's responsible for water spinach control told me at this time it was actually easy to control. they when they find it, they can spray it with either Dyquat or Mazapur. It is in Hawaii, on several of the islands in Hawaii, and we think that's probably because Hawaii is tropical and has a higher mean daily temperature than we have here in Texas. Despite being cultivated for nearly 30 years and having wide distribution throughout the state, including sales in HEB and Whole Foods, water spinach hasn't really become established anywhere outside production facilities. The risk assessment findings included the fact that, again, water spinach has been cultivated for 30 years and that we haven't been able to find it established in the wild. Texas climate is a poor match when compared to climate in areas where water spinach is native. We actually ran computer simulated models. That I had the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service help me with that, and they're very, very low match for almost all of Texas and the and where water spinach is native. Again, temperature data indicate that it'd be difficult for water spinach to survive outside greenhouses year-round. That's probably why, even though people may have been trying to grow it in their backyards, they weren't able to do it because of our winters. Water spinach hasn't exhibited a propensity to for rapid spread. According to the person I talked to in Florida, again, who was in charge of water spinach control and other vegetation control, he said it's not on the rise, it's not spreading. And water spinach, according to Florida folks, is controllable with herbicides. It therefore, our recommendations are to that water spinach should remain on the restricted list here in Texas. That's because we would like to be conservative, since it is on the national noxious weed list. Just in case something happened, we'd like to keep it on our list. This way, we know where it's permitted. We know where to find it, basically. But we believe that people should be allowed to cultivate it and eat it. Commercial cultivation should take place only in TPWD-permitted facilities, and those facilities would be inspected by TPWD staff. And possession for personal consumption should be unrestricted. We would like wholesale and retail outlets to be allowed to possess water spinach and sell it for personal consumption only if they retain invoices from permitted growers within Texas or from persons selling water spinach legally from outside Texas. The reason we had to include the legally from outside Texas is we can get into trouble allowing only sale from Texas growers and not from outside Texas, legal trouble. So we would request today that permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register for public comment. If we were allowed to publish those changes, we plan on working with law enforcement division personnel to help ensure the most effective wording for those changes. Are there any questions?
Discussion about this. Just for clarification of the inspection sites, then if we went forward with this, would just be two areas in the state, or would are there multiple areas in terms of trying to control it and inspect it efficiently?
Currently, the only production facilities we know about are in the Rocheron area. As I said, there are 80 growers, but they're all pretty much in the same community. And so far, we've inspected about 42. I think it is 42 of the facilities.
One other question: can it grow in, you know, waterways and rivers and things where you could not control it with herbicides?
Where, I'm sorry.
Could it potentially grow in a river system or in water?
It could potentially grow in a river system.
An area where we couldn't control it.
But we should be able, yeah, the herbicides that are available today would control it. But even should it get out in the river system like that, because of our temperature, it may survive during the summer, but it should be killed in the winter.
It wouldn't grow. Okay. Questions? Commissioner Duggins.
You said that there was a survey in 2003. Have there been any surveys since then?
In conjunction with the inspection of the 42 facilities, our the biologist from our Bryan office
went looked in the in that whole area around Rocheron to see if he could find any water spinach growing outside the production facilities. And he was unable to find any water spinach growing outside production facilities as well. That was just a few weeks ago.
But how big is the what you're referring to is the Rocheron area?
It's a few square miles.
So we haven't had any survey outside of a few square miles in at least 6 years.
Well, we, except for our public water body surveys, all of our public water bodies are surveyed on a rotating basis. So we're certainly we don't have it in any public water bodies, and we don't have it in any of the areas around where it's being grown.
Well, this concerns me because I went back and focusing on your comments last May, you said on the biological side, once you introduce the organisms, they're there, which is consistent with something that Bob Lusk said back in April 2004, that I would take a native species over the exotic any day of the week, and discussed that the lack of winters makes the problem worse. Now, you say the temperatures in Texas aren't sufficiently high in the winters for this to live, but have you taken into account some of the projections and warming trends that at least I heard on at the A&M conference where temperatures in this state over the next 20 years are projected to increase substantially?
That's one of the reasons we wanted to take a conservative approach and not try to take it off the restricted list, but allow it to be grown with a permit so we could keep track of it. And if something happens, we would then know where it's at and be able to control it and potentially stop production if necessary.
And at your last year, you referred the commission to a website, TexasInvasives.org, and I've given everybody a copy of the printout that's on there and shows Parks and Wildlife as one of the partners. And it says this plant can grow 4 inches, up to 4 inches a day, which is the same thing as water hyacinth. And 84 tons of biomass per acre in 9 months. I mean, it seems to me that this is a pretty substantial risk that staff's asking the commission to take. Would you agree with that?
Well, let me address that in two ways. The reason that that's still on the invasives.org website is that I haven't talked to Damon Waite at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center, who's one of the guys that does the guy in charge of that. He hasn't yet seen the results of the risk analysis, so I'll have a chat with him after that, after today about that. But the fact is that it's been grown here totally unrestricted for 30 years, and at least 30 years, and it hasn't gotten out. Presumably that's because of temperature. So it's been grown, and we find it in Florida, we find it in California, and despite years of cultivation, even in Florida, it's only found in two counties. And despite the high growth rate, is what makes it a good plant for cultivation and for production. But presumably due to our climate, and the fact that it's easily controlled, even after 30 years or more of production, it hasn't gotten out in Florida, California, or Texas. So I think the risks, we believe the risks are relatively minimal. But we would like to keep it on our prohibited list and let it be grown with a permit just in case. We'd like to take a conservative approach.
And we plan to inspect it, and if it does get out, it's in a contained area where we can apply some kind of measure to get rid of it, so we can just watch it.
That's right. We would inspect those facilities on a regular basis and the areas around the facilities. And as I said, our public water bodies are subject to surveys on a rotating basis. Some of them are actually surveyed annually, and others every few years. But that would help us keep an eye on whether or not it actually gotten into public waters. The other thing that's helping us is that the form of water spinach that they're cultivating is what they're calling an upland variety, that really grows in damp soil rather than in the water. That's not, that may be one of the reasons why it hasn't done well in bayous and ditches and creeks in that area, because that, that particular variety doesn't do that well. It's easier for them to cultivate in the greenhouses because it's not like a rice paddy. They don't need water, standing water. They just need damp soil.
Does your recommendation limit it to this one variety, or does it allow cultivation of all varieties?
Well, at this time we're just talking about water spinach, but typically even in Florida, nobody tries to cultivate the more watered variety because it's more difficult to cultivate.
What I'm asking though is, would the proposal, if adopted, allow cultivation of the faster growing variety?
Yes, it would, unless we could easily modify it and put a caveat in there.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. So, so the proposal then is that we would modify it for that. Any problem with that?
Do you have any issue with that? Putting a caveat in there?
No, not at all.
Now you've got a little more. Still allows them to cultivate, but gives us gives the state a little more protection in the natural environment, native environment. Okay.
Okay.
I just want to go on the record and say I'm opposed to it.
Okay. Any other questions?
In regard to, say, giant Avenia or hydrilla, the problematic invasive species that we have to deal with currently, how do they propagate, or what allows them to propagate so much more avidly than, for instance, this or other water species? Why do we have such a problem with that?
Well, let me take them one at a time. Hydrilla is a problem for several reasons. It can reproduce in a number of different ways. It produces axial buds, which can survive for about a year and remain dormant and then germinate or sprout. It produces potato-like tubers that can remain dormant in the substrate for up to 12 years at least. And hydrilla can also reproduce by fragmentation. So, and it grows for about 4 inches a day, as Commissioner Duggan mentioned. So what happens is that even when you think you have hydrilla under control, you've got those tubers remaining dormant in the substrate, and it can come back at any time. And additionally, drawdowns tend to make hydrilla mad, so more of the tubers sprout when you conduct a drawdown. We don't have a lot of water. Water is a big issue in Texas, so if you're going to use a drawdown, then you'd need two drawdowns. Nobody wants to use that much water. Additionally, hydrilla is difficult to harvest, and herbicides are expensive. Some of them cost hundreds of dollars per acre to use. Hydrilla is also one of those that can get caught up on boat motors and trailers and taken all around the state. So that's one of the problems. With giant salvinia, it's a floating species, and it can double. It grows even faster than hydrilla. It can double about once a week. Additionally, it's a floating fern, so it can live out of water for a while, and so it can literally get caught between the boat and the trailer, and survive there for a few days until someone goes to another reservoir, and then it's off and floating again. It's such a small plant that it can get caught up in the weeds, and you can't even find it until it becomes a problem.
How did they get introduced to Texas?
Well, we think hydrilla was introduced as an aquarium plant in Florida in the 50s, and it may have either been introduced as an aquarium plant in Texas, or it may have ridden over here on somebody's boat trailer or in a live well. Giant salvinia could have come that way as well, but it's since it's a floating fern, it's sort of an unusual plant. Some people you could like to sell it at nurseries. I've gotten phone calls from people that say a friend bought it for them because it was an unusual plant, And within a couple of weeks, it completely filled up their pond. They didn't know what to do. So it's being sold in some cases over the internet. It's being sold in nurseries in some cases. One nursery we found a few years ago had 400 cash receipts for giant salvinia. But it too can ride on it. There's a lot of it riding on boat trailers.
And how long? Refresh my memory. How long has the water spinach been growing in California and Florida?
Well, it's been growing in Florida for approximately the same length of time it's growing here, about 30 years. I don't want to make up anything, so I don't remember exactly how long it's been in California.
Do they export it?
Florida does. I'm not sure about California. I think they do too, but I can check for you. But I know Florida exports it for commercial sales.
So local retailers can source it from those two states rather than Texas if necessary.
It's possible.
Let me also note that in our sunset bill, the number one issue the legislature and the committee set out was invasive aquatics, which is a reason, in my view, to be particularly cautious. Two, the website you refer us to says that this species continues to be introduced by immigrant communities. And I would also note that it reproduces not just by seed, but vegetatively, according to this. So I don't think it's a risk worth taking.
But we're watching it and monitoring it closely, and we don't have any indication that it's spread. So.
But we're talking about now facilitating possession of it. We evidently have not been enforcing our rules, but we're now saying it's okay to possess it, and so people can attempt to grow it on their own or pitch it out in the back in a canal, which is where it can proliferate. So I just...
Can they grow it on their own, or is it just... Can they grow it on their own, or is it...
Well, as you said, they could have it for personal consumption.
Right.
The problem with growing on their own is that presumably they could grow it, you know, in their house if they wanted, but our concern would be really isn't whether or not anybody's growing it in the house, because unless Texas warms up significantly, they're not going to be able to grow it year round in the backyard. Our concern would be if they were growing it in an area where it could actually get out and infest public waters and become a problem there.
Sure.
And because of the temperature issue, it looks like that's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in 30 years. And with the totally unrestricted growth, rumors that people have been growing it in their backyard. We actually went to the Asian community in downtown Houston and looked in backyards where people had told us they were trying to grow it, and it wasn't there. Apparently it just can't survive outside greenhouses here. And that's according to the researchers as well.
Thanks. Any other discussion, questions? Okay, thanks, Earl. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish this item in the Texas Register for the required public comment period.
Thank you.
Thank you. Committee item 6, deer tagging and documentation requirement. Clay Wolf, can't forget about deer.
Nope. They need that spinach.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, we don't need more deer either, do we? We need bigger deer.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, for the record, my name is Clayton Wolf. I'm the Director of the Big Game Program in the Wildlife Division. And have good news. I have a very brief item. This is a little bit of follow-up from our March meeting. One proposal that we asked to make modifications to relating to deer tagging and when tagging requirements cease. I would like to remind folks or let you know that our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee has been working on numerous issues for well over a year, almost close to 2 years now, dealing with waste of game, definitions for quartering, and some statutes related to cold storage processing facilities. And Senator Hager, during this last session, actually filed legislation, two bills, Senate Bill 1121 and 1122, that actually would implement almost all the recommendations of the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, and I know that 1121
has been signed by the governor, so that will be effective September 1. Those new statutes and 1122 has been sent to the governor, and we anticipate that it will get signed or passed. So most of those changes will go into effect September 1. This commission does have rulemaking authority to amend or modify tagging requirements, so we chose to use rulemaking authority to deal with the tagging issue that was brought up at the Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee. Currently, carcass tagging requirements cease when a carcass is at a final destination, it's processed for cooking or storage, and it's beyond quarters. And you may recall that technically this could be a problem for someone who quartered a deer and put the whole quarters in their freezer and left the bone in that the tagging requirements technically still remain in effect. And so we had previously, or at least the first time, proposed that carcass tagging requirements would cease when a carcass was at a final destination, processed for cooking or storage, and at least one quarter was removed. After we proposed this, we became aware of a couple of issues. First, there was a question of whether other documentation requirements ceased at the same time, that being the WRD requirements and also proof of sex requirements. And then also, Our law enforcement division brought forth some concerns regarding this, the removal of one quarter, and had some other alternatives to present. And so we took those recommendations and, with your permission, revised the proposal that carcass tagging, wildlife resource document, and proof of sex requirements would all cease when a carcass was at a final destination and the forequarters, hindquarters, and backstraps had been completely severed from the carcass. Additionally, the proposal states that tagging, WRD, and proof of sex requirements cease at a cold storage or processing facility only if the carcass has been logged in the record book, and a record book is required at that facility. Some of this legislation I spoke of actually clarifies that some facilities require a record book and some do not. And so if a person took a carcass to a facility or where a record book is required, they would have to log that in there before tagging requirements would cease. As far as public comment on this, we received 72 comments, 97% agree, 3% disagree, and we had no specific rationale provided for the disagreement. Additionally, we took this back to our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee, and we presented that to them, and we got full concurrence with this proposal as it is published right now. And with that, I'll be glad to take any questions.
Questions? Thanks, Clayton. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. I'll place this item on Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 7, public hunting lands approval, open season on public hunting lands and public hunting activities on state parks. Linda Kim.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, I'm Linda Campbell. I'm the Program Director for Private Lands and Public Hunting, the Wildlife Division. I'm here today to request your action on establishing an open season on public hunting lands and to present proposed public hunting activities on state parks. Establishing an open season on public hunting lands allows the department to hold public hunts during the upcoming hunting season beginning September 1, 2009. Also, statute requires the commission to approve public hunting activities on units of the state park system. In your commission booklets, you are provided with the proposed state park hunts for the 2009-2010 season. There are a total of 1,676 hunt positions proposed on state parks, of which 253 are youth positions. This year, three state park units return to the public hunting program. They are Pernales Falls, Pernales Falls Annex, and Mother Nest State Park. Also this year, there are three new state parks proposing hunts. They include Paladura Canyon, Lake Texana, and Stephen F. Austin. Overall, there are a total of 4,971 hunt positions being offered on both state parks and wildlife management areas, and of these, 1,081 are youth positions. We are down this year by about 581 hunt positions, primarily due to drought, extreme drought conditions throughout much of the state. I wanted to give you just a little background also on in looking at the number of hunt permits offered on WMAs and state parks over the last 12 years. We see that the high was in 1999 and 2000 hunting season. 6,247 permits were offered in that year. Our 12-year average for permits offered is 5,758 permits. The number of permits available has fluctuated over over this time period due to occurrences such as drought and hurricanes. And as mentioned, we are down this year to 4,971, primarily due to extended drought throughout much of the state and also Hurricane Ike.
And then Chapel Rouse.
And this fire, yes, sir.
Fire there.
Yes. And
you're not going to do, sorry, keep it on, you're not going to do hunting in Chaparral. What have you all decided about Chaparral?
No, there are proposed hunts on the Chaparral this year. Yes,
no
sir,
rain either, which is really, it's drought.
Yeah, but we, they've come back fairly nicely down there, and we do have a
good runs after fire.
Yeah. It is noteworthy that our drawn youth hunt positions have increased by 404 positions compared with 10 years ago, and also we're up 193 positions compared with 5 years ago. So providing opportunities for youth continue to be a focus of the public hunting program. To let you know, we are pursuing new partnerships with county and municipal entities to introduce public hunting opportunities on open space lands managed for watershed protection and county parks, and we continue to pursue those opportunities. Again, the main factors affecting our drawn youth hunt permits are the weather fluctuations that affect wildlife populations, drought in particular, natural disasters such as floods, wildfire and hurricanes, and also staff available to run these drawn hunts on both state parks and wildlife management areas.
Can I stop you there, Lynn?
Yes, sir.
Because I know we also do public hunting and make deals, you said, with municipalities and river authorities and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Is that expanding, and how are we doing? Because you don't show that on this list. I mean, how are we doing there? Are we having any luck with that, expanding that?
Yes, I mean, most of our drawn hunt expansion is in the private sector.
Okay.
What we are trying to work with private landowners, municipalities, like I said, county parks, who need the population control that we can provide. We're talking all these opportunities that come up. We are trying to pursue to see if we can put some of this in our public hunting program and at the same time help them with control of population. So that's our main expansion at this point.
And are we having expansion? I mean, I guess what I'm looking for, maybe eventually get some numbers to it.
Yes, and I can do that. We have 100, I have lots of numbers here, 178 positions on the private end this year. That's only about a 9-year program. Our high on that is a little over 200. So we're up and down, but we're continuing to move up on that as well.
I was just going to add, are you getting more acreage? I guess I'm trying to come up with some. I understand you're talking about the permits and that kind of, but are we getting more acreage into the program? Private, municipalities, whatever, counties, are we getting more?
We are trying, yes. On our walk-in hunting, our annual public hunting, not so much. We have lost timber company land.
Yeah,
and we'll continue to do
chunk.
That
yeah.
on our public hunt, our walk-in hunting program. So that's problematic. Our drawn hunts, though, of course, we work with the private entities on that, and those are drawn hunts. They run the hunt, that would be in our draw hunt system that we're working those opportunities.
Linda, let's see if we can. It'd be helpful to us if we could quantify a total statewide opportunity. And get that information to the commission so we just kind of know how we're doing statewide with all of our hunt programs and opportunities.
Okay, both the walk-in program and
sure,
the draw hunt program. Okay.
And just to clarify, you want to see that in number of positions, but also in acres
yes,
lease?
Acres yes.
Okay.
Yes,
that we provide.
Sir. We've got all those numbers and can produce that.
I'm just trying to gauge expansion
yeah.
of opportunity.
Absolutely.
That'd be helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
Sorry to keep interrupting. Can I ask a second question?
Yes, sir.
Relative to resources, our own resources, human resources, are we doing enough, I guess, relative to one, do you have enough people to help with this program, to help try to expand this program, and then whatever else we need, whether it's, you know, working a website or, you know, all of the issues that go
right.
with public hunt.
Well, I can address on the human resources end. On drawn hunts, it does require human resources
yeah.
to run these hunts. And, you know, in the past, and I don't want to speak for state parks, but when they were challenged with their resources, it's difficult
okay.
to get the number of people needed with all the other jobs that they have to do to run these hunts. So drawn hunts is an issue with staff resources.
Okay.
You know, as well as just the competing interest for their time.
Mm-hmm.
Out there.
Sure.
So, you know, I think the answer to that very specifically is no, we don't. You know, we are not in the best position possible to maximize that opportunity. I think everybody is doing as good a job as they absolutely can, given all the competing priorities on their plate. You know, I think it'd be helpful for this commission to know that the division as a whole in wildlife is going through an exercise, really from the ground up, to look at all of their operational priorities and kind of revisit what is most important today that the Wildlife Division be working on. And so I think that's a very, very important exercise that the division is going through, that Clay is leading that team on, and obviously this is one of many topics that they're evaluating. You know, and I think what Linda was also trying to highlight in terms of where she saw the opportunities
yes.
are in the program, one, providing more opportunities to get youth out into the field, and so we've seen some market increase there. Secondly, we are, you know, in the formative stages of trying to work out partnerships with cities and counties that have had very active open space programs and that have super abundant deer populations or hog populations that need to be controlled. We see that as a growth opportunity to provide near urban access. And so we've been meeting with municipalities. The 3,000 acres that we have on the table to acquire from the city of San Antonio to add to Government Canyon. State Parks has been looking at that as an opportunity to provide some managed hunting. So I think we've got some opportunities there that have been new. I know that the team gets this when visiting with landowners about leasing land through the drawing system, you know, the request, do you have, can the Parks and Wildlife staff manage the hunt for them? And, you know, we just don't have those kind of resources. So there are some inherent limitations in the program. As you all recall, in our legislative appropriations request, we made a request to the legislature for some more positions to help us in this regard, and we did not secure funding for that purpose.
We are recently talking also with the National Wildlife Refuge System. One refuge is interested. So we provide a service, and we can start to work those opportunities. I do have the information on the chaparral drawings if you all are interested. For archery on the chaparral, 100 permits are being offered. Either sex, 60, a management, 30, so about 110 between management and javelina. Youth deer, 15 permits. Youth javelina, 40. Youth deer management, 50. So a pretty good roundup for the chaparral this year. One final slide then. Staff recommendation. Staff recommends that this item be placed on Thursday's agenda for public comment and action by the full commission.
Well, in follow-up to the comments that Peter and you made, if you look at the chart for the proposed state park hunts, you have a number of areas where you've got deer and feral hog, a full two that I have some familiarity with, Atlanta and Fairfield, where there are lots of pigs. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to look at this where we could increase the opportunity for feral hog hunting?
Yes.
And it seems to me that's something everybody acknowledges. We need to do what we can to push the numbers back, and that is consistent with your comments, both all of which I agree with, on increasing opportunity.
Yeah,
it seems to me we ought to look at that.
Right.
Increasing the days or the permits somehow on feral hogs.
And we do look at that every year once our proposals are in to look at, you know, what kind of opportunities and what kind of staff are able to do that. Yes, sir.
Commissioner Doug, one reason I'm bringing it up is that we have a resource issue with Texas Parks and Wildlife, the department. I mean, we could do a lot more hunting, so we're limited. And of course, we tried to do something with the legislature this round, didn't have success. So one idea I just threw at Carter, and I'm soliciting ideas here, and Linda, and I think that's what the Wildlife Department's also looking at is, you know, maybe there's a way we can start licensing people to help take these hunts out. See, because one of our problems is that issue, is the human resource side of it. So maybe we can come up with some ideas here that we can either train volunteers to help do it, even license people to do this, or we got to figure out ways to...
I like your idea.
Because we're finding, I think Linda and others have done a pretty good job of finding more real estate, quote-unquote, more acreage. But now our issue
limited
is we're limited in the people resources to be able to do these things.
Well, I like your idea of licensing an outfitter to take hogs.
Well, I'm just throwing out ideas at this point, yeah.
Or volunteers.
Volunteers or
bow hunters or whatever.
Yeah.
Commissioners, Walt Dabney, State Parks Director. We are looking at this pretty carefully. I was just up at Fairfield with a bow, poking tilapia, which is a fun thing to do. It was a new adventure for me, and we looked at the hog problems, and we've got lots of hogs at Fairfield. And I talked to Mike Kleiner, the superintendent there, about doing just that, because we're removing them. We trap them and shoot them, and of course, we have the hunt there. The problem in a state park, unlike a WMA, is if you're going to open it to hunting in the non-hunting season when we actually have the park closed, when there are not many visitors there, and you're trying to conduct hunts, even archery hunts, when you got visitors that you're not controlling, they're wandering all over the place, zipping through the woods on a mountain bike or hiking or whatever they're doing, you got some inherent issues there that are not so easy to control, and as Carter was talking about personnel challenges and staffing, you've really got to have some people committed to this to make sure that if you're going to have these kind of things going on at the same time, that you're not setting people up to get hurt. And so we have some great opportunities. We have some disjunct sites that we're going to look carefully at where we can, in fact, have the main park closed and some areas open that are not in the main visitor use area, which I think could provide some great, especially feral hog hunting opportunities. And I think, realistically, we're probably talking more archery than we're talking gun hunting, especially in a situation where you have the park open to other visitor uses. But we are genuinely looking at this. I think it's a great opportunity. Plus, as the chairman said, it's a resource issue. These things are just absolutely knocking us dead out there right now.
As an example of that, in Powder Canyon, that they're going to now allow feral hogs in the canyon, walk me through the process of how the public is going to be notified that there will be areas of that canyon where people are hunting.
Well, every time that we go through there's a proclamation, it's posted, it's on our website, it's probably in the local paper, whatever it is that says what the hunting dates are and what the restrictions are in the park, and in many cases the park is actually closed to other public use. That works pretty well. We have very few complaints because it's truly in the middle of cold season in most cases, and the conflicts are not great. And again, it's couched, first of all, as a resource issue where we're trying to reduce, we're trying to control either deer populations, hogs, other exotics, whatever it is. And secondly, certainly to provide hunting opportunities. So we don't have too many parks that we will certainly at least not have a gun hunt going on when people are out hiking trails and that kind of thing. It just can't work. And so we have a process in place. In most cases, the hunts are controlled where our staff literally drives the people out to the areas either to a stand or they have a compartment that they have to stay within, which is well marked for the day, and then we actually go out and pick them up again as well. So it's very controlled. If you had the park open to park visitation, we've got to figure out the logistics of how you would do that successfully and again, not set someone up to...
Well, and there's also, I guess, in my mind, the issue of impacting potential gate revenue because you've got the hunters in place and you can't allow the non-hunters entrance.
That is absolutely true. You're talking about a very few hunters we would be able to accommodate that could displace a whole lot of traditional park users. So, again, our best chance is in places where we have a disjunct location, like he called it the annex or whatever at Pardinalis, where you're literally across the river, other visitors aren't going there. We could hunt, and we'll look at that. We could hunt pigs there more year-round.
Well, and I guess in my neighborhood also in Caladero, there's sections of the canyon that you could totally isolate from any other pedestrian or mountain bike traffic or horse traffic for that matter. But, you know, the feral hog issue is something that we are going to be addressing more and more.
Oh, yeah.
And I think every opportunity we have to limit their population is something we need to seriously look into.
The other thing is we have a feral animal policy as well as an exotic animal policy that certainly affects all the division, but state parks is one of the biggest ones. And our folks are qualified. They have to qualify each year of resource management weaponry to be able to, as they see the opportunity, to remove exotics or feral animals, and we do that. And we do that as low profile as possible. Our intent is not to inflame the public with the fact, but whether you're whatever kind of feral animal you're talking about has an absolute impact on what should be there naturally, and so we have a policy that's consistent in resource management with taking care of those on a daily basis.
This just one other thing I'll add. This is a very timely discussion. Mark Duda, who runs Responsive Management, who does a lot of the human dimension research work for all of the fish and wildlife agencies around the country, is doing a national study on public hunting opportunities and what are the programs that are working well, what are the key barriers that we need to address, like how do we take it to scale with leasing more land, providing near urban areas, providing mentors to get kids out into the field. I think there are going to be some very helpful things that come out of that national study that we ought to come back and share with y'all when that's done in the next year or two. I think the team does a really good job of trying to squeeze out every possible position they can on the WMAs and the parks. I mean, we definitely hear you about trying to do more any chance we can on the feral hogs. If we are truly going to take it to another scale with respect to amount of acreage, that's going to have to be in concert and partnership with private landowners and having resources to lease those lands. So,
on the private lands, how do you target the who you're going to lease to in the private land opportunities? How do you target the land?
Well, we have had people that have worked with us over a number of years. We always go back to them and see if they would like to continue to work with us. We're always interested in new folks that want to come into the program, and we do have a limited budget on that, and so we have not advertised it widely, I suppose, because we spend our money on it, our budgeted money for that. We lease hunt positions on private lands for those landowners who are interested under a contract agreement with us, and we pay by the hunt position. The landowner sets the bag. They run the hunt. We provide the hunter with their rules, and so the landowner is in the driver's seat on that. And,
so the landowner does operate the hunts themselves,
yes,
so it helps on a human resource area.
That's correct, yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I think that's why there's some areas we need to expand.
Yeah.
And then another opportunity has been the river authorities and others. Now, that's where, again, we'll either have to come up with the human resource or find some way. But if you think about it philosophically, Texas Park and Wildlife, long-term, I mean, we've got to develop, expand public hunting dramatically here, because we've got to get people opportunities. When 97% or whatever the number is, 95% of the land in Texas is privately held, I think it's our job to do more and more outreach, and so we've got to figure this out, and we're behind the curve, in my opinion.
Well, the private expansion is is the way we see it.
Yeah.
Because you just said it, 97% private.
That's right. Questions?
Thank you.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. Appreciate all your hard work. Okay, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action, and I think that completes our business.